guys are not yet asleep. Maybe they don't have to go to school tomorrow because of the snow. But still, we'll pick up his mailbag first and then come back to you. You do have a report on this private launch. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
I didn't have one. I said, you know, if you wanted to, we could talk about that. But that was a week or so ago, so the SpaceX launch. You know, we talked about how that went, and it was a success. So I don't know if you want to be subject to death or not, but no, that's all I had, Dick. I really didn't have a report. Back to you, Dick. WS.
Very fine, Paul. So we're going to go to mail first, mailbag, and then back to you. Even though it's old news, it's a week old. We didn't have a space report last week, and so I didn't keep track of this one, so I'd like to know about it. Mel, K2KEY, what kind of questions have you been getting this week? And I hope people are a little bit more appreciative of the so-called new improved TechNet. And we're going to get better. We're actually getting to the mailbag before 9 o'clock. First time in a long time. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yes, most definitely I have gotten some very positive about new improved version of the TechNet. And I think it's a great formula that we're working on now to keep everybody's interest and cover, like you say, basically everything is beginning. I'm just reading over here. Oh, okay, here's one. We've got a number of compliments and things. And the kids, of course, are off from school for the Christmas break. So a little bit light this week. Emails, but here's one. Last week you mentioned that if you want to use a Yagi on 2 meters and want to vertically polarize it, the mask can become somewhat of a problem because it would present some kind of interaction with the antenna because it winds up actually, like you said, another element. I think you said something to that effect, Dick. If you wanted to offset it, some way mount it offset, how do you go about that? And how much? How much would you have to offset it, say, from the mask? How would you go about it, and how much? That's the question, Dick. Over.
Yeah, when you're building a vertically polarized Yagi, or building, when you've got a Yagi in your hand, and the hardware that comes with it allows you to mount it as a horizontally polarized thing. In other words, all the elements are parallel to the ground, and your mast coming out of the top of your tower or the mast coming out of the top of your chimney of your house is a vertically polarized mast. It's cross-polarized, and there is essentially zero interaction, unless that mast happens to be 8 inches in diameter, which we don't do. Other than that, on 2 meters, no interaction for a horizontal Yagi. For a reasonable diameter mast, like 1.5 inches, and a vertically polarized Yagi, your eyesight sees the vertical elements, sees that vertical metallic mast, and you lose a lot of sleep over that one. You have nightmares over that one. If you ignore this, the amount of degradation in performance in most situations is quite small, because the hidden piece of information for any reasonable size Yagi, reasonable size, 4, 5, 6 and more elements, that Yagi itself has an effective capture area that's a hell of a lot bigger than common sense would dictate. If your eyes operated at 2 meters, let me drop. If your eyes operated at 2 meters and you're looking at a 6-element Yagi, I could work out the exact mathematics of this. And what you would be doing is using the formula, gain x 4 pi a over lambda squared. If you know the true gain of the antenna and you anti-log it as a real number, plug it into that formula and solve for area. A 6-element Yagi on 2 meters probably has a area that's equivalent to something like a 8-foot diameter circle. If your eyes operated at 2 meters and you were standing out in front of that Yagi and you looked down that boom, you would see an 8-foot or so, maybe a 9-foot diameter black circle, all vertically polarized energy, in the case of a vertical Yagi, entering that black circle would be sucked up, be focused by those directors, like a magnifying glass, onto the driven element. All of that energy from that 8 or 9 foot diameter circle would go down the feed line and move the S meter on the receiver. Now when you look at it from a real area relationship, antennas, it is my strong recommendation that you start thinking in area. Many of the books do not do that. Most of the classes do not do that. They give you a bunch of formulas, say, do this, and you don't know what in the world you're doing. In reality, anything that's receiving a signal, whether it be a microphone, whether it be a loudspeaker, whether it be your a loudspeaker used backwards, whether it be your telescope, whether it be your antenna, everything has a real area to it when it comes to receiving signal. So once you look at that 8-foot diameter circle of my example for a 6-element Yagi on 2 meters, and that's going to be close to the right numbers, 8 or 9 foot diameter, and you realize that it's got 60 some odd square feet of effective area to it, and that 1.5 inch diameter mast is casting a shadow on that area, and the shadow is, 1 or 2%, nothing. So when it comes to the shadowing effect,
repeater, timeout, cancel.
So when it comes to the shadowing effect of that mast, that's a second order effect, very, very minor. The primary effect that the mast has is that the mast lies close to the nearest two directors that are close to the mounting clamp. Therefore, that mast being close to those directors is adding some extra capacitance, because it's a metallic object, near the tip of those directors. Therefore, that extra capacitance tuned those directors a little bit lower in frequency. By way of a modeling program, if you wanted to, or by way of experimenting, if you wanted to, you could re-change the length of those two nearest directors, make them a little bit shorter by the right amount. You would retune the antenna even for the detrimental effect of the nearby vertical mast. And that vertical mast would essentially disappear. You would be within 0.05 dB of the gain of that Yagi as if the mast wasn't there. And that vertical mast is a beautiful, strong way of mounting the antenna. I do not recommend going over to a wooden, fiberglass, PVC, or whatever mast, because you're still going to run the feed line down it, in most cases, and you're going to run into the exact same problem again. Now, when you want to offset it, let me drop. Because the mounting hardware on the Yagi you've purchased or built usually is made for mounting a mast at right angles to the elements, polarization-wise. You could, if you want to, connect another piece of aluminum tubing at right angles to your mast with the right kind of a mounting plate and U-bolts. And now, with that horizontal piece of tubing mounted to your mast, off to one side, you mount your vertically polarized Yagi. And now your Yagi is mounted to a piece of tubing that's at right angles to it and has no interaction. How far away should it be? Since a 6-element Yagi, in my example, on 2 meters, has an effective capture area of approximately an 8 or a 9-foot diameter circle, if that mast is a 2 or 3 feet off to one side, you're only talking about the radius now, not the diameter, 2 or 3 feet off to one side would be more than enough. And now you've got two choices. In order to make everything come out right, you can extend the mast beyond, you can extend the horizontal piece of tubing in the other direction beyond the mast, and put a counterweight on there if you wanted to, in order for things to be gravity balanced, or you could put a second Yagi there and run two vertically polarized Yagis, horizontally stacked. There's pros and cons to doing that. And if you're only going to put a counterweight on the other side, just to make everything weight-wise balanced, you don't have to, but to put a small piece of aluminum sheet metal there would balance the wind load. You'd like to have an antenna wind balanced so that when the wind blows, the antenna doesn't tend to turn itself downwind, if you know what I mean. I would prefer a second Yagi off to the side, and now you're running a pair of vertically polarized Yagis. By way of a set of relays you could put into the feeding harness, you could decide to feed one Yagi when you want a nice, clean pattern.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Then when you want to listen to a weak signal after you've peaked them up on the single Yagi, you flip the relay switch that turns the two Yagis on, both of them side by side. And by the way, impedance matching in this situation is very minor. If you had nothing but a T connector doing the impedance matching or the power dividing, that's only a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. For most 2-meter rigs, that's nothing. That's a 0.5 dB of loss in the worst situation. And there's ways you can compensate for that. So just just making the two feed lines the same length from the T-connector going to the two Yagis with the relay. That's the one thing you got to worry about. Make them the same length so that the electronic steering of the beam happens to equal the bore sight, if you know what I mean. The idea of turning on the second Yagi means the signals you listen to just got 3 dB louder. And it's automatically giving you the wind load and the gravity balancing and whatever. So a pair of vertically polarized Yagis, horizontally displaced, on a horizontal piece of tubing mounted to your vertical mast, is a very good way to go. The reason for the relay is because when you're running a pair of Yagis side by side, it doesn't matter if they're horizontally or vertically polarized, a pair of horizontally displaced Yagis gives you a much more complicated antenna pattern. You get all the gain you're supposed to get. The main lobe gets 3 dB stronger. The main lobe gets a hell of a lot more narrow, and you develop a whole lot of side lobes. The side lobes are not an error of the antennas. It is the laws of physics of interferometry. As you rotate this whole array away from, let's say you're listening to a signal to the north, and you start rotating toward the east. You're rotating the whole array top view clockwise. One antenna is being shoved forward, the other is being shoved back. They're starting to receive the signals out of phase. That's what's making those nulls and those side lobes. Interferometry. Laws of physics. Nothing to do with the antennas. That more complicated antenna pattern is a lot more difficult to pick up a signal on. So when you flip the relay and you only run...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You flip the relay so that you're only running one Yagi. Picking up on a signal is a lot easier. Then once you know the guy that you're listening to is in the bore sight and you'd like to hear him 3 dB louder, you flip the relay and now you got both signals, both antennas running simultaneously, and life is good when everything gets 3 dB louder and you can listen to that weak one and work them. In the case of 2-meter Yagis, homebrewing them out of coat hanger wire and pieces of aluminum slats and pieces of wood. There's lots of articles about how to homebrew 2-meter Yagis. So you don't have to spend a lot of money if you're short on money, and you can develop a hell of a lot of gain by building a pair of these Yagis. And with a pair of vertically polarized Yagis, it would be a lot of fun to aim them at certain repeaters. If you'd like 2-meter repeater FM work, find out how many you can work, how far away. If you're getting interference from one of those repeaters, and the nice thing about an interferometry pattern is it's got some deep nulls. You can intentionally aim one of those deep nulls at an offending repeater, a strong local repeater, when you want to listen to the one far away. So there's a lot of advantages in doing that. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, sounds great. This is K2KEY. All right, covered that pretty well. Here's another one that's on a similar subject. A 2-meter quad antenna. You don't hear very much about that, but I saw somebody that has one. It looks like a very nice antenna. I believe it's homemade, four elements. Will that suffice if I had one for 2 meters? I have another one made up, homebrew, for 70 centimeters. Would it suffice as being both for horizontal and vertical polarization? That's a good question. Really, what can you expect from a quad on either 2 meters or 70 centimeters? I know that antenna for a while I don't know if they were being produced commercially, but seems to have a lot of interest with that Quaggy. If you can make some comments about it, Dick, over.
Yeah, starting in the early 70s, because a number of people were moving from the HF band up to the 70 centimeter band, single side band in particular, and because quad antennas, typical quad antennas, were believed to be having more gain on HF frequencies. Slightly controversial subject, because later measurements made by the same guy, Wayne Oberbeck, K6YNB, he went driving around California where a number of guys are running horizontal Yagis and some of them running horizontally polarized quad Yagis, cubical quad Yagis, and with his expandable mast that was on a trailer, He would park a mile away from each one of these stations and compare signal strengths of a guy with a known power, which this guy is running 500 watts, and I stand a mile away from him, and when he aims the antenna at me, I get a signal that strong. He went and made a bunch of measurements like that, reported it in Ham Radio Magazine, and by way of the archives of Ham Radio, if you're a ARRL member, you can find that article by Wayne Overbeck. His call letters then were K6YNB, Yankee November Bravo, and I think he's got a slightly new November 6 call. I think it's November 6, YN or YB or NB. He's made a slight change. But once you know the name, Wayne Overbeck, stand by. You can find this data set that he gathered. The bottom line was that a cubicle quad looks like it's got a lot more copper and antenna and aluminum in the air. Everyone believes they have more gain. And his answer was almost no. There was a very, very slight increase in gain on HF frequencies of the same number of elements of cubicle quad versus the same number of elements of Yagi. Was all of that extra gain, was that little bit of extra gain worth all of that extra wind load of the cubicle quad approach? And the answer seemed to be no. But because he did that experiment in roughly 1980, and this is the early 70s, and in the early 70s, quite a few of the guys on 70 centimeters were building cubicle quad antennas, and the so-called Quaggy antenna, quad loop Yagi antenna, done by Wayne Overbeck, had a cubicle quad reflector, cubicle quad driven element, and I think all the other elements were normal dipole-like elements. A very popular antenna in California, made out of inexpensive materials, wooden boom, and something like coat hanger wire, or a copper 14-gauge household wire for most of those elements. A popular antenna in the early 70s, and it did enter in the antenna competitions of the East Coast VHF Society, and when that antenna came out and was becoming popular, let me drop the question deck. We'll pick a balanced question in a minute. When that antenna, the cubicle quad antenna, first came out and became popular, roughly 1978, that just by coincidence happened to be the exact same year I introduced the insulated Yagi for 432. And by the way, you can now see a picture of the method of construction of the RIW-19 Yagi if you look at the front cover of QST Magazine, January 2011. There you will see, why can't I think of his name? The main lab technician, the guy who I talked to so darn often, I can't think of his name right now. There it is, Zach Lau, W1VT. He used to be KH6 UK, I think was his call letters. Anyhow, he's on the front cover. You'll see the method of construction where the elements of the Yagi are going through the boom with shoulder bushings as a method of insulating from the boom. It gives you a huge advantage. And the driven element has got this folded dipole-like structure, which really is a T-match, fed with a half-wave coax balun. All of that is the RIW-19 Yagi, of invented 1977. Let me drop. And it became a commercial product of a company called RIW Products in those days. It doesn't exist now, so I can tell you about it. And RIW Products was my good friend W2KRM, living in Babylon at the time. He decided to manufacture these antennas as a kid. So he made the refinement of the elements going through the boom with the shoulder bushings, with the star washers holding them down. A very nice construction technique. He's an extremely good mechanical engineer as well as electronic engineer, George, W2KRM, who invented that. But you have to dig a little bit to find out the reference that to give us the credit for that. In the antenna book, the antenna manual, that antenna is described as built by K1FO, and he, in his original articles, gives a lot of credit to W2KRM and to K2RIW, as does the product review of roughly 1978 in QST Magazine. Because it was a commercial product, it was reviewed, and they give a lot of credit there, but no credit since. Anyhow, that method of construction as a Yagi, as I said, I went in competition head-to-head against Wayne Overbeck himself in the antenna contest of the East Coast VHF Society. I think it was either 1978 or 1979. And does the cubicle quad Yagi have more gain? The answer appears to be no. a nice method of construction if you like it. But if you're doing it because you want extra performance, I don't think it has it. That's part of the answer I think you're looking for. Let's find out what Alan's question is. KC2, RFN, K2RIW.
KC2, RFN. good evening, Dick. Good evening, Mel. When you talk about the cubicle quad and you seem to be stacking it up against the Yagi, should I be viewing it as the Yagi is picking up the E field and the cubicle quad is picking up the H field, or the magnetic component of the signal? Is that basically the difference between the two, Dick?
Don, good question, Alan, with good common sense. And the answer is no. A cubicle quad antenna, where you make the elements of a cubicle quad very, very close to one full wavelength of circumference. What you could do is to take a horizontally polarized cubicle quad, which means you're feeding it in the center, usually, the center of the lower horizontal arm of that cubicle quad. And each one of those sides are exactly a quarter wavelength long electronically. That is a very elaborate horizontally polarized dipole. You could, if you want to, cut the middle of each vertical leg of that cubicle quad right in the center. You would then say you've got a U-shaped dipole on the bottom. You have an inverted U-shaped dipole on the top. You could put a separate feed line to the upper dipole and to the lower dipole. Now you've got two U-shaped dipoles, one inverted, one right side up. Feed them in phase. You would get the exact same performance out of the antenna. No change in gain, no change in pattern. Vertical, horizontal, I mean, the E-plane pattern, the H-plane pattern, everything would be the same. Now you suddenly realize, gee, the elaborate, the sexy way of feeding that upper dipole, the upper inverted U, let me drop. The sexy way of feeding the upper one is just to not do that cutting along the vertical sides. Let the high voltage point of the lower U-shaped dipole do the feeding of the upper inverted dipole. That's what's exactly happening. Because you've got two dipoles vertically stacked, you would like to think you've got more gain. If you're feeding nothing but a driven element that way, as opposed to a pure horizontal dipole, yes, you would get a little bit of extra gain. When you're doing it as a Yagi, the answer is no. The main reason for that is the vertical stacking distance is much too close to really give you two thoroughly independent elements. So yes, it looks like a loop. In the case of a real H-field antenna, the circumference of one single turn of the loop is usually considerably smaller than a wavelength. And now it's not a resonant length, but you force it into resonance by putting the right amount of capacitance across the feed point. A circular loop that is less than a wavelength long is a pure inductor. You resonate it with a capacitor, and whether you call it a ferrite loop without the ferrite, or whether you call it a loop antenna, is your choice. And you could, if you want to, make multiple turns of it. But so in the case of a real loop antenna, in almost all cases, it is a very non-resonant antenna until you add the tuning capacitor. Then you become a nearly pure H-field antenna. But in the case of a cubicle quad, it really is two vertically stacked, horizontally polarized dipoles, and it is almost a purely, I can't call it an H-field sensing antenna. A dipole, if someone asked the question, let me drop, this is a beautiful one. If someone asked the question, does a horizontally polarized dipole pick up H-field or E-field? The answer is yes. Which one is it favoring? That's a tough one. So a pure dipole is really picking up an electromagnetic wave. I think it slightly favors the E-field, but I'm not sure about that. But a small circumference loop, particularly with a ferrite rod in it, starts switching over to being almost a pure H-field antenna. Don, good question. Wonder if that helps a little bit, Alan. It's not the complete answer, but I think it's the trend. KC2RFN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Hey, KC2 RFN. Yes, you're right, Dick. I forgot that the for it to be a loop, it has to be considerably less than one wavelength the entire circumference of the ring or of the loop. I forgot that portion of it. So now I see how it can't possibly be a cubical quad. But having that information opens up a whole new vista of antenna designs and experimentation, which is what I'm working on now. You really should see my house. It's loaded with different antenna experiments. And congratulations for them putting your RIW antenna once again on the cover. I wonder if they did that purposefully or not. Looks like you're getting a lot of national recognition. And ham radio, Dick, back to you.
Okay, the RIW-19 Yagi method of construction is what's on the front cover of the January 2011 issue of QST Magazine. But that happens to be a six-element 432 or 70-centimeter Yagi that Zach Lau, the main engineering manager of the laboratory at ARRL, is building. I've met Zach, by the way, quite a few times. Talked to him a whole lot of times during a 70-centimeter contest, N10 gigahertz contest. Interesting, a guy who originally came from Hawaii, had a KH6 call in the beginning. So that six-element Yagi for 70 centimeters on the front cover is the RIW-19 method of construction. No credit is given in the issue itself or in the so-called our cover. You'd have to do some more digging to find out that method of construction. Now, Zach Lau got a hold of me roughly 2000, came to the conclusion that the method of construction was not being given enough recognition, and he was attempting to make correction on the later issues of the amateur radio handbook or the antenna book, where that method of construction and that Yagi design were being described, and the variation to it, which is the K1FO. The K1FO, a beautiful 22-element 70-centimeter Yagi, done by Steve Polishin, in his original article, he gives lots of credit to RIW and to W2KRM. But other than that, no credit is being given. If you were a UHFer from way back, you would know where the design came from. The new guys looking at that will say, I don't recognize that. I don't know where that came from. It's a nice, strong method of construction. And it's got, because the elements are insulated from the boom, and they're not therefore building up aluminum oxide and breaking contact with the boom, you don't suffer that huge electronic detuning that takes place downrange a year or two if you have the elements going through the boom. The,
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The man who ran the world above 50 megacycles for a whole lot of years had a 13-element Yagi. Why can't I think of his name? A cold that is right now. Boy, am I getting old. Mel, who is the guy who invented the world above 50 megs? Please tell us, Mel, because all of a sudden my mind's going blank. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Chilton.
That's it, Ed Chilton. W1HDQ. Ed Chilton. Ed Chilton, W1HDQ, invented the Chilton 13-element Yagi, which was, in its day, roughly 1970, the highest performance Yagi anyone knew about. The elements were nice and easily screwed, you know, a little hole through the boom. The elements went through the boom with a vertical screw to hold them tight. And that method of construction, when you first built it, gave you a rather high performance Yagi. But I remember buying some of those Yagis from a friend of mine who was no longer using them, and I went down the string with my ohmmeter, and I found that something like one-third of the elements no longer made any contact, left side or right side, with the boom, because the aluminum oxide had built up. And when you measure the gain of those, I think I bought four of them from the guy, when you measure the gain of the four Yagis, even though physically they were all carefully built to the exact same dimensions, I came up with four different gain numbers, because as the elements break contact with the boom, the electrical length of the element changes significantly, and your Yagi with 13 elements goes into a detuning mode. I measured that characteristic in roughly 1973, and I said, hey, a solution is required. I came up with the insulated Yagi in 1976, 77 on my backyard antenna range. In those days, I was insulating the elements from the boom by setting them into plastic blocks that set on top of the boom, and the plastic blocks were held to the boom with pop rivets. It solved the problem electronically. Mechanically, it was kind of a nightmare. And along came George, W2KRM, who came up with this idea of the hell with putting the blocks on top of the boom with the pop rivets, but the elements through the boom with the shoulder bushings. And he used, by the way, black Delrin ultraviolet protection shoulder bushings, exotic material, and therefore they have very long ultraviolet survival. I know we've gotten very far off your original subject, Mel, so I better pass it back to you in a hurry. K2KEY, K2RIW.
We are with a quick comment.
Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, I don't know if you're aware of it. When I put up the 2 meter, Barry put up the 2 meter and 432 antennas that I own by M squared. They're using your technique, the shoulder bushings and those retaining clips. So I was quite impressed with it, needless to say, and they work very well. I have a 12 element on 2 meters, and I have a 28 element on 432.
Yeah, very nice, Rich. George W2KRM at the time, 1977, did a huge search for right materials for those sliding retainers and those shoulder bushings. Those shoulder bushings were never intended for antenna service. I think they were intended for some kind of electrical contracting service. I forget what the original intent was. So this is a weird mixture of materials never intended for an antenna. But now people have seen them for so many years, have come to accept them as antenna elements, and never knew what their original origin was. K2KEY, K2RIW, go ahead with the next question if you'd like to, Mel.
Well, we didn't get an answer to that, so is the quad, that was the question, will the quad, 2 meter quad, or a 2 meter, 70 centimeter quad, fulfill the need of an antenna system that will be viable for, let's say, making contact with some of the repeaters or doing some simplex. What is the answer to that? That was the question, over.
Would a cubicle quad for 2 meters or 70 centimeters be a viable antenna to talk to repeaters, horizontally, vertically polarized? Absolutely. Now the real question is, what's making you deciding to build the antenna in a cubicle quad manner as opposed to a Yagi manner? If I built a cubicle quad antenna, and I want it to be vertically polarized, and now I'm feeding one of the vertical arms of the cubicle quad driven element, and in your eye that may look like the vertical mast is no longer giving you a blockage. Maybe that was the original intent. Turns out the amount of blockage and the amount of detuning is almost identical, cubicle quad versus normal dipole Yagi-like. So if you happen to like the cubicle quad construction technique, go right ahead and do it. Very inexpensive materials will give you a nice performance antenna. The exact same materials in cost, with a slightly different method of construction, with a dipole-like antenna, vertically polarized, will give you the exact same performance. If I built a one-element, two-element, or a five-element cubicle quad on 2 meters, say for instance, or if I built a five-element dipole-type Yagi on 2 meters, I'll get essentially the exact same performance. So when you choose one versus the other, let me drop. When you choose one versus the other, you're choosing a method of construction. You're not choosing performance, even though you may think you are. And you may think you're getting away from the detriment of the vertical mast. I think the answer is no. And by the way, going back one step to what the beautiful question that Alan asked, is the driven element of a quad antenna an H-field antenna? There's a second reason why you can say absolutely not. If I had a vertically polarized loop antenna, which really is an H-field sensing antenna, it would be picking up the maximum signal 90 degrees away. If I had the plane of the loop perpendicular to the Earth, and if I had the plane of the loop oriented east and west, if it was a cubicle quad antenna, I'd be receiving signals from the north or the south. If it was a pure H-field antenna, I'd be receiving signals from the east or the west. a pure H-field antenna picks up signals at right angles to where a cubical quad element picks up. A second strong piece of evidence that it's not an H-field sensing antenna. It's a dipole, it's a pair of vertically stacked dipoles. So, good questions, good common sense, and Mother Nature once again makes the real world a little bit more complicated. But to repeat your answer, Mel, choose whichever method of construction you like. You're not getting an electronic advantage when you choose a cubical quad versus dipole construction. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, good. Put that to rest. All right, well, here I have a thing. There was an antenna that you say through the boom construction. A company called Telrex, T-E-L-R-E-X. They were popular back before. They're out of business for a long time. Just their popularity through the 50s, 60s. One of the companies, original companies that started making really Yagis, commercial Yagis, them, I think Mosley maybe also in the same mix at the time. Collins was also producing, I believe, a Yagi. Telrex put through the boom these elements and heliarced them to the boom. They were welded. They were welded to the boom. And they were like, a couple of feet they'd stick out, stick off the center of the boom and where they welded through, and then you slipped your element over that. So I think that construction of maybe like, that heliarchy construction that they did, and that special sleeve that they had in the middle, that was quite a contraption in the middle of the boom where they had this T-type sleeve that so that the booms continued basically still be in the center, but they had this special T with this insulating setup in there. It was quite an advanced piece of antenna, I think, for that day's tick over.
Yeah, I think the Telrex company was in New Jersey, a major antenna manufacturer in the late 60s, early 70s. Came up with some nice products, and also the chief engineer had a couple of articles in QST magazine about the so-called wide-spaced Yagi. And their advertising claim at the time was wide spacing gives you more gain. Absolutely not true, but everyone believes it at the time, and many people bought the antenna because of that. The guy who's done the most serious research on Yagis throughout his lifetime is Dr. Gunter Hawk, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. Dr. Gunter Hawk in Darmstadt, Germany. A lot of people call him Mr. Herr Yagi because he has taken every single Yagi design that's available to him on planet Earth, no matter what frequency it's on. He's made a 70-centimeter equivalent of the antenna and tested them in the great big antenna testing chamber that was available to him at the time at the Research Institute of the German Federal Post Office in Darmstadt, Germany. So he had access to that antenna range, and he tested every one of those antenna designs. And in Dubis magazine, he's had a number of significant articles. Let me drop. In which he has presented the graphs of various Yagis with their performance vertical. Their gain is the vertical axis of the Yagi. The horizontal axis is the length of boom in wavelengths. And so all of those popular or unpopular, world's best and worst, so to speak, antenna designs are somewhere on some of his graphs. If you Google the word PL6WU, you'll come across quite a significant number of articles, as I said, particularly in Dubis magazine, the German magazine, which has an equivalent English translation, which will present you quite a bit of that data. Anyhow, Gunter Hauck has come out with a very respected formula that tells you essentially exactly what gain you're going to get out of your Yagi, and that gain is only a function of how many wavelengths is the boom length. The snow that's hitting the antenna at the repeater site tonight is what's creating the static you're hearing. And so unless you're right next door to the repeater and giving it a kilowatt of power, you're going to be hearing some of that static as these charged snow particles are hitting that antenna. Let me drop. The bottom line point is that all of this research done by Dr. Hock is that if you use approximately the right number of directors in approximately the right positions for your particular Yagi design, and there's lots of Yagi designs, once you've come up with a reasonable performance Yagi design, you can make a Yagi design with a whole lot of elements on that boom or very few elements on the boom within reason. And you'll soon discover the true gain of the antenna is the number of wavelengths of boom, period. And so-called wide spacing, does it give you extra gain? Absolutely not. But Telerex engineers were claiming that as a great breakthrough, and there were some controversial articles in the late 50s on that exact subject in QST magazine. Now, with this Telerex, by the way, there are a number of commercial antennas. Let me drop. There are a number of commercial antennas where the elements go through the boom and are welded to the boom. And as long as they've done a good job of aluminum welding and the weld doesn't break, that's an antenna that does have longevity outdoors. There are a number of other kinds of Yagi designs where there are various things welded to the boom, and then the element makes a compression contact to that structure. You take, for instance, the Cushcraft Yagis, where you've got the saddle-shaped metal element on top, and the element sits across that saddle and it's screwed down to it. Does that get around the problem? It slightly alleviates the problem because now the element is further away from the center of mass of the boom. But you still have aluminum to aluminum contact, and you're going to suffer a little bit of gain degradation as the elements break contact with that aluminum saddle. On top of that, the other thing that I fault the Cushcraft Yagi design for, which, by the way, is a very high-performance antenna when it comes to dollars per dB. You get a lot of antenna for the money, and the Cushcraft design for a lot of years was available everywhere. Easy to buy. Well stocked. But because the elements are eighth-inch diameter, not 3/16, the 2-meter elements suffer a lot of bending problems. There's a whole lot of those Yagis where the Yagi struck the tower while somebody was climbing the tower with the antenna to install it, and bent the element, and then bent it back, and you can only bend them a certain number of times before they break, or when birds sit on those elements, they bend them, or when ice gets on those elements. It turns out that 2-meter elements that are only an eighth-inch diameter are much too small in diameter. Two or three disadvantages. They bend too easily, they break and fail, and also they detune when you get ice on them. As the elements of a Yagi get larger in diameter, they become stronger, the gain improves, opposite of a lot of common sense and a lot of articles written on the subject, and the amount of water degradation from water droplets on a heavy dew morning sitting on the antenna, the water droplets...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The detuning characteristics of the antenna become drastically decreased when you go to 3/16 diameter aluminum rods for the elements as opposed to 1/8 inch. So, if you're building a Yagi out of coat hanger wire indoors, and it's not going to be exposed to the weather, no problem. And if the elements, if your Yagi only has, let's say, 3 or 4 elements to it, the design is nowhere near that sensitive. You get to 6 and more elements of a Yagi, and you have small diameter elements, and it's outdoors, exposed to water droplets, snow, ice simulation and whatever, there's a lot of disadvantage of using small diameter elements outdoors. I think this is some of the information you're seeking. I probably went off on another subject again, another tangent again, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. All right. Well, just final comments here on Telerex. The information that you said about white spacing, it was based on Telerex was marketing, if you remember, an antenna called the Big Bertha, that rotating pole that was a well casing pole, that pipe that was approximately, I don't know, 10 inches in diameter, and I don't know, tapered, I think, started out, you know, quite a hefty piece of pipe and went up like over 100 feet. And they claim that's where their measurements, and that's where their claim on the wide spacing performs better in on that system of using it on the Big Bertha, the big rotating setup that they had, Dick. And that's basically, you know, where a lot of that information, that experiment with Telerex went on to become that kind of antenna that, like you say, had tremendous popularity, became a very, you know, big in the commercial field because it was not only amateur radio over.
Rich recognized, when that big Bertha antenna, which I think was a large rotating mast with a great big chain drive at the bottom, if I remember correctly, are you saying because of the diameter of that mast, Mel, that the wide space Yagi was more compatible when it was mounted on that mast? Is that sort of what you're saying? Mel first?
I read extensively on that because I once went out to New Jersey years ago to visit the Pam I knew that basically started out as an officer. Together, got a call at the same time, basically, and became friends, got on the air together and all. And, I could say he was extremely comfortable money-wise, and parents would give him literally anything he wanted. They had a huge piece of property out there in New Jersey, and they bought him a big Bertha antenna. So I got quite interested in it, and, or engineers came down and supervise the installation of the thing, which, let me tell you something, it saved money with $100,000 at least, maybe that more than $150,000 today's money. And I remember reading, the material he had and everything on it. At that trip, they did a lot of experiments because most of the antennas that were on that big Bertha, were all stacked arrays. So they were, pushing stacked arrays on that thing, stacking them. The big long boom Yagis, basically, Dick, over.
Yeah, since it is now essentially universally accepted that the length of the boom in wavelengths tells you the gain of the antenna, when you Google Gunter Hawk's call letters, you'll find his formula that he has written on that subject, which I've got a copy of it in my handheld calculator. By the way, you're hearing lots of precipitation static in the antenna of the repeater, and that's why you're hearing dropouts of L signal in mine. So I can tell a lot of snow is falling in Queens right now. Let's see, if I go to higher power, almost over for that. I wish I had my afterburner in here tonight. Anyhow, the length of the boom is what gives you the gain. And when you look at that, the Gunter gain, very well respected gain form, that snow is really getting wicked. It has a number of added to the length of the boom. The boom in length, we take the I'm having trouble getting through here tonight. You take the large number and feed it through this formula. You add that to the constant offset, gives you the predicted gain for that wavelength. You can get that I can, Rich. N2EO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, and so we are also making it through. I'm on the little rig upstairs with the antenna on the air conditioner, so I'm wondering about 50 miles. Up really bad around 6 o'clock on 5. It was really bad that static charged no particles. Dick, just a piece of trivia. That big Bertha with the stacked arrays, I think that's the antenna that was the UFT time, a picture of the late Senator Barry Goldwater in Scottsdale, Arizona, K7 UGA. He ran a Mars station and a ham station from his home in Scottsdale. And I believe that's exactly what he had, the big Bertha with the stacked antennas. Am I correct?
I think the answer is yes. K7 UGA was his Arizona call. K3UIG was his Washington call of Barry Goldwater, a presidential candidate. We came very close by way of that Barry Goldwater presidential run of roughly 1964. We came very close to having a ham radio president at that time. And yes, I think he did have a big burden among the people who were well off economically. This huge pole, which I think was about 75 feet tall or 90 feet tall, depending on which one you bought. It was a single aluminum pole that became wider. It went below grade. It had this huge chain drive to rotate this pole, and you could stack your antennas along this pole as a establishing your antennas that all rotated at once. And so you did all kinds of vertical stacking of HF, VHF, UHF antennas. Let me drop. The major problem with that mole pole is there was no good way to climb it. I don't think it ever had climbing rungs on it. Therefore, once you bought this expensive antenna, you also, in my opinion, bought very expensive maintenance. You're going to be hiring a cherry picker to come to your house, or a crane, to install your new antenna or to maintain your antennas, to service those antennas. Because I think there was no way of climbing that pole. Let me pass it over to Mel to see if that was correct. I think that pole was essentially unclimbable, and I think there was something like a 70-foot version and a 90-foot version. There may have even been a 120-foot version of the so-called Big Bertha. K2KEY. Now bring us up to speed on that one, Mel. K2RIW in the deck, man.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Okay, first of all, the Big Bertha, this pole was not aluminum. That was steel. It was a rail casing used for oil wells. It was the material that they used for drilling oil wells. So the casing type was a steel type. And it had the one I looked at, and I know that was a standard feature of it. It had a cover that rode up the pole. It was a steel cable. It went up there someplace. It had a winch. And you sit in a boatswain type chair, and it's sexy enough, and you ride up the pole thing, and it was big. It was a lot more than 90 feet. The one I looked at, we had, I'd say it was about at least 150, 175 feet tall, and it was stacked with beams. Oh, stacked type, especially 20 meters. 4 over 4 over 4 and things like that. It was an amazing thing, and the piece of equipment, the turner, that's chained. It was a humongous chain, like one cable, most likely some big piece of a commercial, like a tractor or some doggone thing, and it was below ground. They used this concrete box, huge concrete box, ground with the rope. On top, and they either bolted it or welded the second sections on. It was a humongous setup, and yeah, Barry Goldwater was one of the ones that had it, and there was another guy, W7LJA, Little Johnny Appleseed, that had, he was the only one in the country, believe it or not, had two of these for some reason. I got his QSL card, which was ridiculous. He sent QSL cards, and he used to put them in an 8x10 envelope. It was a huge picture of his shack and his antenna system. Why he had to have two of these, I don't know, but it was beyond comprehension what these guys were doing.
When you have it flaunted, he had permission from his local zoning board, he had a big piece of property, he had the money for it. That's a lot of fun thing to do, so to speak. By the way, while we're on the QST magazine, the January issue, there was a beautiful article that I wish Hal K60 had, we'll get a chance to look at. On page 59 of the January issue, in the so-called Hands-On Radio, has a beautiful article on open wire transmission lines. And the nice thing about that article is that in the middle of the page, it has a formula that tells you exactly how much power will be radiated by open wire lines, parallel quickly lines, so to speak. Once you know the spacing between the lines, you can predict for your particular frequency exactly how much power is going to be radiated by it. Let me drop. So if you chose, for instance, 450 or 600 ohm open wire line on, say, for instance, 80 or 40 meters, and you plug your parameters into that formula, you'll find out that the radiation is going to be something like 60 dB down, where it's the open wire line radiates, but the signal radiates is 60 dB down. 60 dB down means that it's 1 millionth the power of what's coming out of your dipole. Now when you add a very high standing wave ratio to open wire line, because you've got a highly mistuned antenna, that means you've got a certain amount of power flowing up, you've got a certain amount of power going back. By definition, you've got a very high standing wave ratio. Because you've got a high standing wave ratio, the maximum standing wave ratio you can get on a line, let me see if that's correct. That would only be true if your transmitter is 50 ohms. Under normal circumstances, it's rather unlikely that the maximum voltage on your open wire line, because of high standing wave ratio, is going to be more than twice normal, double the voltage. Because of double the voltage, you might get as much as 6 decibels more radiation because of standing wave ratio. So is Hal right that the open wire line radiates? To a degree, yes. Let me drop. But there's a catch. If the line has 60 decibels of non-radiation to begin with, in other words, it's 60 dB weaker in radiation compared to the signal coming out of your dipole, and now because of high standing wave ratio, the radiated signal is 6 decibels stronger. You go from 60 dB down to 54 dB down. Does that mean your open wire line is radiating? Yes, it is radiating a 6 decibel louder signal. But if it's radiating a signal that's 54 dB down, which is approximately 1/250,000, you know, with a quarter of a million, weaker than the real signal coming out of the antenna, I say that's not a problem. So from my point of view, open wire line and the radiation because of standing wave ratio at reasonable frequencies is a non-issue. Now, if you're foolish enough, let me drop. If you're foolish enough to use 600 ohm open wire line and you go high enough in frequency where the number of wavelengths between your two lines is now becoming appreciable, like maybe a 16th or an 8th of a wavelength, yes, that will be a radiating system. And whether you've got standing wave ratio on it is a moot point, if you know what I mean. So open wire line on HF frequencies is an extremely high performance transmission line, and very inexpensive. In order for you to equal the same kind of performance out of coax, you'd have to be using some very large diameter, very expensive coax. So it gives you a lot of bang for the dollar on open wire line, and with open wire line, because at HF frequencies, the losses are darn low, you can now tolerate extremely high standing wave ratios. You can take an 80-meter antenna and feed it on 40 meters, 80-meter dipole, feed it on 40 meters, where the standing wave ratio might be 100 to 1, because the impedance of the antenna on double the frequency goes to numbers like 1,500 ohms. And 50 divided into 1,500, you can do that. It's probably a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio. As long as your antenna tuner can handle that, that would be a high-performance antenna. Try doing that with coax, and you're going to suffer miserably, because coax with a 30 to 1 standing wave ratio is going to give you a lot of excess loss. So you pays your money, you take your space. And as usual, the answer is a little bit more complicated than first meets the eye. What else is there? Do you want to handle one more mailbag mail? Because I think we backed up a little bit on those. And the guys with being off this week, maybe they can stay up late enough to listen to at least one more. K2KEY. And your signal is coming through the static a little bit better than mine. K2LIW on the TechNet. You got a mail.
Blizzard conditions out there. Well, there is one article that you may be interested in reading someday, and it was written by Barney, G5RV.
controlled theater radiation. It was a unique wavelength.